a few simple notes. All right. Well, first I'd like to thank the organizers for organizing this meeting. It's been great fun. And after just one day, I realized that, all right, I'm not so sure what a natural law is anymore. And so I regret the title of my talk. So we're going to talk about the role of order in something. I think about models. I think about building models and theories. So we'll think about that. So we talk a lot about how natural law reflects order in the universe, and we have a lot of ideas about this. And what this suggests is that natural law derives from order. And if this is really the case, if we really truly believe this, then we ought to be able to take ideas based on ordering principles and derive natural laws from them. So physicists have been using symmetry for a long time. Certainly since particle physics, symmetry has become critical in trying to understand our relations among quantum systems and things like this. And so, but the important things here is that symmetry deals with equivalence relations among partition sets, which is related to group theory. But there's really been an entirely different area that's been missed, and this is order. And order deals with order relations among ordered sets, which is lattice theory. And as powerful as symmetry has been in physics, this has really been untapped. This is an entirely different area that imposes different constraints on your physical theories that complements symmetry in some very nice ways. So I'm going to talk about order and how we can use this to derive theories. So just a very short introduction of partially ordered sets and these ideas. Basically, you have a set of elements, and this set of elements is endowed with some kind of ordering relation. So you have some concept of one element being able to be greater than another, or one element includes another. So we'll see different examples of this. So here's a nice example from Stonehenge, a little bridge here. And you can see that you have the left side, the right side, and a span. And here are the parts of a bridge. To be able to have the span, if you have the span up, well, certainly you have the left side and you have the right side. So these are ordered in some sense. So these diagrams basically are showing the order relation. These are called Hasse diagrams. I'm not going to go into a lot of details about how this all works, but just the critical points. This is a partially ordered set. I have a set of four elements. These elements are ordered such that this element includes these two. This one also includes these two. And this is another one, another partially ordered set. They're both partially ordered sets. And this element here includes everything below it. This one here includes everything below it, and so on. Now, there's an important distinction between what we call posets or partially ordered sets in general and lattices. And lattices are special in that if you consider a pair of elements, and you look at their upper bound, all the elements above them, there is, in a lattice, there is a unique least upper bound and a unique greatest lower bound. So here, if I look at all the elements above them, there's two elements, and there's no minimum. There's no least upper bound here. If I look at two elements here, and everybody above these two, it would be this one and this one, there is a least element, so this is the least upper bound. Since this is unique, what you can do is you can take this concept of a least upper bound and you can look at it in terms of an operator. So I can talk about this as being an operator where I basically join these two elements to create an element up here, and I can look at what's called the meat of two elements, look at the element directly below the two, right? I can't do that here because they're not unique. So we're going to focus on lattices. But we will still talk about posets a little bit near the end. Now, one of the other important ideas here is that lattices are algebras. So you have a structural viewpoint here. Some element may be less than or equal, or less than in some sense with respect to your ordering relation. So think of this as a generic symbol. I like to think of it as inclusion. So B includes A is the way that I usually look at this. That's the structural viewpoint that gives you this hierarchy, if you will, of elements. The operational viewpoint is the viewpoint when you start looking at the join and the meet as algebraic operations. So the join, if B includes A, that means B is above A. So the join of A and B is B, and the meet of A and B is A. So their join would be, the greatest upper bound of these two would be just B, and the least upper bound would be B, and the greatest lower bound would be A. Now, to just show how generic this is, I'm going to transform these into totally different domains. So we can talk about set theory. So we can have one set being a subset of the other, and that's the structural viewpoint. The operational viewpoint is the union and the intersection. You can look at implication among assertions. You have the structural viewpoint where you have implication. On the right side, you have logical ands and ors. If you talk, you can order the positive integers by division, which integers divide which other integers. And there's that gives you a structural viewpoint. And the least common multiple and greatest common divisor give you the algebraic viewpoint. And then last, the very familiar integers just ordered according to whether one's greater than or equal to another. And you can see the operational viewpoint there again. So these operations will come up later once we transform this algebra and give it a little extra structure and turn it into a calculus. So this is our plan. We're going to take this algebra and we're going to look at these structures and we're going to quantify them in some way. And we're going to find that the structure of the algebra, the lattice structure, imposes very strong constraints on the ways that you can quantify these sets. And when you take that into account, we'll create a calculus. So we're going to start out with a case study in basically deriving probability. So this is some work that I had done quite a while ago now. And this is actually forms a new foundation for probability theory in that it's based on order theory. It encompasses Kolmogorov's ideas. And for those of you familiar with Cox and his generalizing Boolean algebras to probabilities, but it also encompasses those ideas. So it kind of unifies those two groups. Dave Finetti is out. He is on betting, which I can't see how why you would. Dave Finetti. He.
His ghost resides back here.
Oh, all right.
I'm the unfortunate holder of his soul.
All right, so we're going to consider a very simple inference problem. I have a bag of fruit, or I have a bag and a grocery bag, and in it I have a piece of fruit. You don't know which kind of fruit it is. It could be an apple, a banana, or a cherry. These are the possible states, if you will, of the piece of fruit in my grocery bag. And what I can do now is I can generate take the power set, which is the set of all possible subsets of these three states. And I can order these subsets according to subset inclusion. So here's the set that contains all three. Here's one that contains just A and C. And here's one that contains just A. And you can see, of course, that A, the set that contains A is a subset of the set that contains A and C, and so on. These are a way to encode statements that you can make about the states. These are all the possible statements you could make about the state of the fruit. So if you're totally ignorant about the state of the fruit in the bag, then your statement would be, well, it's A, B, or C. I don't know. I don't know anything about it. But then Philip could come along and say, well, I got a quick peek and I can tell you it's not a banana. Right? So then you've learned something. Now your state of knowledge goes down to A and C. You can make the statement, well, it's either an apple or a cherry. And these are very definite states. You might learn something a little bit more and find out that what's too big to be a cherry, it has to be an apple. So we're going to actually work and quantify this. But this is the basic structure, for the algebraic structure.
So your basic statements are, it is not something that is information for you.
That would be information, yeah.
But
once we generalize this to a calculus, you can get all sorts of information. So ordering here, I'm sorry?
Was there a connection between the
between A, C, and B.
The connection between which?
A, C, and B.
A, C, and that is wrong. No. That's a mistake. Thank you. Sorry. I got a little excited putting in the vertical lines. All right. Yes. That does not belong. Right. Thank you. So subset inclusion in this picture encodes implications. So if you know that it's a cherry, that implies that it's also that implies the statement it's banana or a cherry, and the statement it's an apple, banana, or cherry. What's important is that inference works backwards. When you're performing inference, you want to quantify the degree, to what degree, knowing that the system is in one of the three states, so you know it's one of these states, to what degree does knowing this imply that it's in this state, right? Or to what degree, knowing that it's either an apple, banana, or a cherry, does it imply that it's an apple? That's what we want to quantify here. So inference works backwards, and now to quantify this, we have to put on another layer. We're going to basically quantify this partially ordered set. Now, we're going to start by just quantifying the elements, but we'll see to do probability like this, we have to quantify pairs of elements, because you want to see how this is related to this. So to perform such a quantification, we want to assign real numbers to the elements. Any quantification must be consistent with this lattice structure. Otherwise, information about this partial order is lost. So if we have a desire to maintain this information about the ordering, we need to make sure that our quantification is consistent with it. So we're going to do this by enforcing local consistency, and we're going to introduce this function that takes a lattice element to a real number. So this element here, the join of x and y, so that's a symbol for the join, or in this case, it's, since we're working with probability theory and statements, you can think of this as an or. So the number we assigned to this element has to be some function of these two elements. Now, I'm looking at a very special case here. We're going to try to derive a general rule, and if there exists a general rule, then it must hold for special cases. So we're going to look at a very simple lattice that doesn't have a meet, or the meet is a null. and we're going to use this to derive the basic part of the rule, and then we're going to generalize to general lattices. So the number we assign to this element has to be a function of the number we assign to this and the number we assign to this. So we write this as f would represent the number we assign to x or y, and this has to be some function, I don't know what the function is, we'll call it s, of the numbers we assign to the two other elements. So the goal is to figure out what this function s is.
And that's just an arbitrary axiom that checks to be true.
Yes. Yeah, well, if this does isn't true, then the quantification won't encode the partial order.
Okay, I could imagine other kinds of axioms put there, right?
I can't think of any, but we can maybe talk about that. So now what we're going to do is I'll look at a bigger lattice that I haven't drawn here, one that has more elements. And we're going to consider the fact that you have an associative property where I could take the join of y and z first and then take the join of that pair with x. But I could have also taken the join of x and y and then joined it with z. And these two are the same element. So you have associativity of the join. Now this turns out to be critical. We're going to use associativity again and again and again. And we'll find out that you can really get a lot out of this property. So so associativity of the join means that these two elements are the same. But according to our function, I can write them in different ways. So this one will have this function s will be nested in here, and then again on the outside. And writing it this way puts the function on the inside here in such a way that the function s is now encoding this concept of associativity. So now we have a functional equation we'd like to solve. This is the equation we want to solve. I'm not going to work through this derivation. These things are really very difficult. And Janosch Axel solved this back in 1966. And he actually is a professor here in Waterloo. So, but his solution, he shows that this function S is related to basically a summation here via an arbitrary function F. So F can be any function, and this will basically hold. So what do you do with this? Well, you do the simplest thing you can. You say, well, look, I'm going to regraduate. I'm going to redefine everything so that there's some function V which will be assigning my values. So I'm not going to assign this value little f. I'm going to assign a value big F composed with little f. Right? This will be the number that I assign. And if you write it out this way, basically you've regraduated, and it's a freedom, basically, to a summation form. So this is enforced by associativity. And what you have here is basically a derivation of what is an axiom in measure theory. So in measure theory, summation is usually an axiom, but you see here that this actually must hold if you're going to enforce associativity. So if you're working on lattices, then this summation is basically a reflection of associativity on the lattice. So now basically we have this valuation, this quantification that we're going to take each element to a real number. And we, with this simple picture, I've just drawn this to show a connection here according to this equation, I can write the number that I assign to x or y, or x join y, as a sum of the numbers that I assign to its two components. And now we want to consider a more general case, a case where there's things below. So here's the little picture I'm going to use. And I'll just go through a simple graphical proof. So if we consider those three elements, we have the sum rule there on the left. But I can also consider these three elements, and I get the sum rule on the right. And now you can see that we both have V sub Z coming in here, and we're going to substitute one into the other. And this gives the more general sum rule. So I have the number that I assigned to x or y is the number I assigned to x plus the number I assigned to y minus the number I assigned to x and y, or the meat of x and y. So from those of you who've done some probability theory recently, you probably remember this as being the simple sum rule in probability theory. But this doesn't have to be probability theory. We're doing this for lattices. This holds for lattices in general, which means that we should see this equation appear all over the place. So this is the sum rule. People, even in probability theory, often think of it as a rule relating ors to the other elements, but it's actually symmetric. You can rewrite it and solve for and. What it basically is saying, that the number you assign here plus the number you assign there has to be equal to the number you assign there plus the number you assign there. So it relates the elements of this lattice. And indeed, it does appear all over the place. We'll talk about bivaluations in a little bit, which are two numbers. But just to give you a little foreshadowing, you can see here's the sum rule in probability. This is the rule for mutual information. There it is again. This is Polya's min-max rule, which is trivial but cute. The maximum of x and y is the sum of the two minus the minimum. This is the Euler characteristic in geometry. Again, the sum rule, a little bit of a different form. And this is in number theory, working with division and integers, positive integers ordered by division. So indeed, this appears all over the place. And this is all just a consequence of associativity.
So ordered equation follows topological reasoning and sort of follows just from that structure.
That's right. Now we can do other things with lattices. We can take lattice products. So here's the lattice on the left, another lattice on the right. And you can create the lattice product. So you can imagine taking one of these lattices, forms this, and at each vertex or each element of this lattice, I'm going to introduce the other one, and you basically get a new structure. Each element is denoted by the Cartesian product of the two elements in the factors on the left. Now this is also associative. The lattice product of two lattices B and C, taken with the product of A, is equal to doing A and B first, and then taking the product with C. And now if you work through this the same constraints we have, we would end up with the associativity equation again. However, we can't have both sum rules at the same time. And so if you, but remember that, that capital F is arbitrary in the solution to the associativity equation. And so with a little bit of algebra, you can show that since the only freedom left is rescaling in the sum rule, this one takes the form of a product rule. So if you take logs here, you basically get the sum rule back again, which is, which reflects the associativity. So product rules and sum rules are both due to associativity. they just are both holding at the same time. So one of them takes the form of a sum, the other takes the form of a product. And before I go on, I'll mention that Philip's talk after mine is going to be talking about quantum mechanics, and he'll be talking about pairs of numbers, and he'll derive a sum rule for pairs and a product rule for pairs. So these are the rules that you use to combine quantum amplitudes. This is all over the place. So now we're going to branch out a little bit, and instead of just taking one, taking a lattice element to one real number, we're going to take two lattice elements to a real number so we can compare elements. And this is called a bivaluation. I'll use a W instead of a V. There's two of them, two little dips. So here we have the bivaluation. We'll call this element here the context. we can write it this way. If you keep the context constant, you can imagine this as just being a valuation with the context held constant. And so these are the bivaluations should match up with the valuations as long as your context is constant. So we can immediately write the sum rule and the product rule in terms of bivaluations where the context is held constant. So here's the sum rule with the context constant and the product direct product rule with the context again held constant. Now you can do some other fun things. Because we're comparing pairs of elements, we can imagine comparing these two elements, but I can do this in pieces. I can compare these two first and then these two. I can decompose this into comparing each of them individually. But again, we have associativity. I can compare this with this and then with that, or I can compare this with that and then with that. And that's basically the idea again. So associativity comes into this. I'm not going to work through the proof, but again, you get a product rule, and this is the product rule. So this says that the language I will use here is the degree to which C includes A is the degree to which B or C includes B times the degree to which B includes A. So it just decomposes this chain into segments. And again, you may, if for those of you who know the product rule in quantum mechanics, you can see shadows of this here as well. Actually, that's not accurate. It's the direct product rule, not this one. Sorry. all right, so now we want to extend the chain rule. The chain rule is very nice along chains, but we want to consider more general lattices. So here's a little lemma. If we look at this small diamond here, and I write the sum rule where the context is this element, x, I have the sum rule here, but since x includes itself, and we have the freedom of scaling. So for probability scaling, we're going to choose a norm of 1. This will be equal to 1. And since x join y includes x, that's also equal to 1. So this element is also equal to 1. So we can equate the other remaining 2. So this says that the degree to which x includes y is the degree to which x includes x and y. And what we've succeeded in doing is abstracting this idea of inclusion into incomparable elements, right? So at first we talked about how we're comparing elements along a chain, to what degree one might include another. But now this by this construction, you can now abstract that idea to compare elements that with this calculus that in the algebra are incomparable. And this is very powerful. So here's how we would extend the chain rule. This is the chain rule for those three elements down there on the lower left. And now we're going to apply the lemma to each piece, basically move off the chain. So this element here transforms to this, just like we just showed. this element here maps to this one, and that element there maps to that. And when we're all done, we are, instead of comparing these three elements on a chain, we're comparing these three elements that don't lie on a chain. And we end up with the product rule for probability theory. So the degree to which X includes Y and Z is the degree to which X includes Y times the degree to which X and Y includes Z. This is the regular product rule in probability theory. So again, it comes about from associativity. So these are, in fact, constraint equations. If you have a lattice structure and you want to quantify it, you need, if this quantification is going to encode that lattice structure or the structure of that algebra, you have to obey, your quantification has to obey these three constraint equations. So that's what you're basically doing when you're doing problems in probability theory. You have this Boolean lattice. You know some of the values of some of the elements, your priors, and some of the likelihoods, and now basically you're calculating you're using the product rules to calculate the bivaluations for other elements on the lattice. And those are the elements you're interested in computing, the degree to which they might be implied by the truism. You can take this one step further. You can look at the product rule and look at commutivity. And by imposing commutivity, you can write the product rule two different ways. And rearranging things, you get Bayes' theorem. So Bayes' theorem here, you can see, involves a change of context. You have some original context X, and you wanted to flip things around and change that to a context Y. And you can do that with Bayes' theorem here.
Should I be worried about dividing by zero in any of these steps?
No.
That's the thing that I'll provide.
Yeah, the bottom guy is zero, but that's the falsity, at least in probability theory. Some of the other lattices structures, you might have to worry a little bit. I'm not sure about exactly
could
that
it
problem.
Could it be that you've derived it in a product way rather than in a quotient way? So in this other development of probability, which you don't like so much, you can derive a Bayes' rule in a product form. So that you see, you know, if you have zero over here, well, then this means divide by
zero.
Right. You're not dividing by zero.
Yeah, that's what you would have. You basically start with this product rule here,
okay.
And you flip around y and z. So this would be z instead of y. That would be y and z. And so there's the two different ways. And so if you
the more careful statement on the next slide wouldn't have involved quotients. You would just have products.
Yeah, exactly. You wouldn't have divided by zero if you had that. Thank you. All right, so there you have it. There's the derivation of Bayesian probability theory, without assuming the summation of a measure, but looking at the lattice structure that arises from the relationships between statements, implication among statements. So we have a sum rule, a product rule, and Bayes' theorem. Yeah, and these hold for any lattice. That's right. You do have to be careful with general lattices because you can get negative measures with the sum rule, which wreak havoc with the product rule. And so if you want a measure where you it's always positive, that's not always possible. But you can have a quantification, if you accept negative numbers.
Is there some illustration you put on the lattice so that you always get positive?
That I don't know. I know for Boolean lattices it'll always be positive, but
right.
But in general I don't know.
You don't have classification of larger classes.
No.
An obvious question in light of what you were talking about quantum mechanics: what if we have the mapping not go to the reals but to complex numbers?
Actually, I'll let Philip handle that.
Okay.
All right. Now we're going to look at another study. This is very recent. I actually submitted a paper to the archive last night. So this paper will appear on Monday on deriving special relativity. I'm going to give the Kitty's version and go only to the point of deriving the Minkowski metric. So we start out with the single postulate, the event postulate. Events are fundamental. Some events have the potential to be informed of or influenced by other events. However, this potential isn't reciprocal. So the idea is you can have an event an event that can find out about another event, but it can't be the other way around. So again, you have a partial order. So if event A can be informed about event B, then it's not possible that B can be informed about A. And this gives you the causal sets that many people here in the room are familiar with.
What exactly do you mean by informed by? Because I'm thinking I have a correlation between two things that I can, you know, find out about the earlier one by probing the later one. It seems to me maybe you mean something like causally influenced by.
Yeah,
if you're changing the later one, I can't.
Right. So you can think of it as it's a causal relationship. So if they have the potential to be causally related, then you have that can go one way, but it can't be the other way.
Would you agree that informed by is a bad way of describing that?
No, because I'm talking about whether the event can be influenced by another event. So that's why I said or influenced by here. I don't want to say that event A is actually going to be influenced by event B. That might not be the case, but if it has the potential to be, is a different thing, right? So it's a causal relationship, but not a cause and effect relationship.
Maybe potentially influenced by is what you're trying to capture.
Yeah, that's why I want. Yeah, so potential should be sifting down into that, right? So now we have a bit of a problem because we quantified lattices in the last picture, and that's very nice because you actually can translate this to an operation to get an algebra out of this. You don't actually have an algebra here because you don't have this uniqueness of joins. There's a few things you can do. We're going to do something a bit different. So this is just a slide showing how, talking about partially ordered sets again, which we've gone through. Now we don't have a concept of time here per se, but there is a concept of ordering, and there's a critical distinction, and this will come up actually in some of the work that happens in quantum mechanics too. Because of this potential to be influenced by, you have an idea of ordering, but you don't have a notion of closeness. So I can't say that these two points are closer than these two points. This diagram is a cartoon. It can be stretched and pulled and all sorts of things, as long as you don't flip the order of any two events, right? That's actually a great freedom. So what we're going to do, we're going to represent an observer as a chain of events. So we'll call this a chain of events, an observer. Not all chains are observers, but all observers are chains. So a chain is a set of events that are completely ordered. And we're going to choose to quantify the partially ordered set in such a way that the chains are simple. All right? And here I'll draw them as being simple as straight lines. This is just a picture. We haven't done any quantification yet. But this is a cartoon of what we're going to do through this quantification.
So what is the definition?
I'm sorry?
What is the definition?
Oh, well, simple. I'll explain what I mean by simple in a bit. But we want to think of it in terms of pictures. We want to make this picture look simple, right? We have the freedom, because there's no notion of distance, we have the freedom to stretch this any way we want. So let's stretch it so it looks nice. Now, what I think looks nice might be different than what you think looks nice, and that could be important. I mean, you'll see that my way of making things look nice gives us an interesting quantification. You might come up with a different way to make things look nice, and... So I'm going to define a term here. This is a projection. Projection of event X onto the chain is given by the least element piece of X on the chain that can be informed about X or influenced by X. So this guy can't be influenced by X. This guy can, that guy can, that guy can, that guy can, that guy can. He's the least element that can. So we're going to call this element the projection. So there's a... In this picture, there's another implicit assumption kind of floating around in that we have lots of elements here. I'm only drawing just a few of them, and I can pick certain ones. I can always find one that I need. So there's some idea of homogeneity or continuity floating around here. Yeah, that's right.
Okay, it's
not just that.
So what is it just technically? Is that a whole set?
I'm not sure. All right, so we're going to quantify these as simply as we can, and here's what I mean by simple. We're just going to count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We're going to rank them. That's the simplest way I can imagine to do it. So we'll choose these integers as labels. You could use pi, 2 pi, 3 pi, whatever you like. But we all know from relativity that you need two observers or two people floating around in an empty universe to be able to quantify motion, right? You can't have relative motion if you just have one person. You need two people. So we need two observers to quantify things. So we're going to introduce another chain. Now we have to choose this chain carefully. This mirrors what is done in special relativity with synchronizing clocks. We're going to choose events. So we're going to call these quantifying events. These are special events on the chain that we're going to use for quantification. And we're going to choose them in such a way that successive events in one chain map to successive quantifying events in another chain, and vice versa. Right? So these guys are all project to each other. So I'm not drawing all the lines, all the... it's not really a Hasse diagram.
That would not be so easy generally to pick out the rules in
such a situation, that you get this nice thing.
Well, if these points are very dense, then you can do that. But
is it fair to say you're introducing other axioms besides the one you started with, simply saying that one event is can be informed of, and there's lots of other things you're sliding in here?
Right. This is the one thing I wasn't aware of when I started doing this, because when you see these postulates, there's two postulates or three postulates. There's always many, many more. When you look at Einstein's derivation of special relativity, you assume that there's motion, you assume there's space, you assume there's time, you assume that the two observers can have the same clock, you assume all sorts of things. So the other assumption I'm saying here is I can always find an event on this chain such that this condition holds.
Okay, that seems a bit stronger than assuming there's space and time.
Well, you can argue about that, right?
So if I may, so that this is some sort of a static space-time assumption, right? Because you can imagine it's being changed in the space-time. So
it's actually going to generate a space-time, but
yeah. But if it's a space-time, it's a very special kind of space-time. I guess that's what you guys are going to say.
Yeah. You don't get gravity out of this. So there's another this assumption of being able to find an event, which is the only other assumption I can find, is apparently a critical one.
Can I just make it clear?
Sure.
You've drawn those two from P and the one above it going parallel up. Is it not possible that the top one goes below the thing? I mean,
something like this.
Isn't that a relationship in a causal set as well? So that you're selecting out things at this stage?
I'm not sure. I'd have to think if that would violate causality. But I'm not selecting anything out. I'm just showing how we would go about creating events here that are synchronized with these events.
Yeah,
I'm selecting these events such that these two project to these two, and so on. It's equivalent to saying I they're going to use the same clock. But is what it's going to turn out to be. So now once you have these, what you're basically doing here is you have a lattice, or you have a partially ordered set. Now, you can't quantify a partially ordered set in terms of an algebra, because there is no algebra. You don't have this uniqueness of joins and meets. So what you do this by through the process of distinguishing, selecting elements and putting them into another class that's distinguished from the rest of the partially ordered set. So this chain of events here is distinguished, and this chain of events here is distinguished. And now basically we have two lattices, these are both lattices, that you can then use for quantification. That's the general idea. Now what you can do is you can now quantify some of the events in the partially ordered set by how they project onto these two chains. Not all events project onto the chains, I'm not going to assume that, so you can't necessarily quantify every event. These two observers might not be aware of everything going on in the universe. So now if you consider two events here's two different events, they have their own projections, and we can represent these as pairs. Now, since this labeling is arbitrary, I can relabel things, and so that I can choose the origin here if I want, I can choose an origin there, I have this freedom. So we're going. What's important here is the difference between these two events, when the difference between the events at which observer P is aware of one, event one, and observer P is aware of event two, and this difference between the events at which observer Q is aware of event one and observer Q is aware of event two. And so we write this as a pair, and which is equal to this. So basically, you're quantifying events in the partially ordered set with pairs of numbers. You'll note very quickly that there's two fundamental configurations. There's the symmetric configuration that's chain-like, where this event projects to events in P1 and or P and Q, such that the order at which these two events are observed by the two chains is constant or the same. This situation is the anti-symmetric situation where the order is reversed. This chain P finds out about event 1 first and then finds out about event 2, and chain Q finds out about event 2 Qs, event 2 first, and then event 1 later. Perfect. All right, so then we have a natural decomposition here into this symmetric component and an anti-symmetric component. So this is a decomposition into the pair into a symmetric piece and an anti-symmetric piece. And this is equivalent to introducing another event or finding another event such that you can do this decomposition, relate these pairs. You can look at it this way. So again, this hypothesis that you can always find an event somewhere seems to be critical. So we can introduce what I'll call coordinates. We'll call T the symmetric coordinate, X the anti-symmetric coordinate, and now you can rewrite the pair like this and see that it decomposes in such a way. Now, I only have a few minutes. Don't have time to go through the proof, but we have basically a pair representation, which we're going to see again in quantum mechanics, and this is very suggestive. Like I said, this is very new, so we don't know the relationships there yet. It turns out that if you now want a scalar measure, there's actually only two possible scalar measures if you go back to the lattice structure and rework trying to define a measure. There's this one, which is the sum of the two, which is proportional to t, and you get the scalar interval, which is the product of the two. So this product of the two, actually, you can imagine is coming from the lattice product. You've got one chain here, one chain there. There are two lattices. You've got scalar measures on each chain. You now take the direct product of the two lattices. This direct product multiplies the two valuations together, like we derived for probability theory. And so this gives you the product of these two, which you see right away is your Minkowski metric. So you basically can derive this relationship from a quantification of this partially ordered set by distinguishing particular events and then that form a lattice and then using the lattice structure to introduce a quantification. That's the basic idea. No, well, I mean, you can change the labels x and t, but what matters is the and this is coming from this minus sign comes from this anti-symmetry, which is related to the fact that the two observers have the potential to observe the events in different orders. This is where I've always wondered where the anti-symmetry of space comes from. You know, I was always told when doing geometric algebra, well, space is anti-symmetric. Well, what does that mean? And this is what it means. It means that if two events are separated in space, they have the potential to be observed at different orders by different observers. Now you can go on from here, which I don't have, but you can introduce other observers that aren't related via this nice synchronization, but are related in a linear fashion, where one observer's events project to some interval on one chain and a different interval on the other. And we find out with that linear relationship that you end up, if you try to get a transformation from the pairs of one frame to the pairs of the other, you end up with Lorentz transformations. So it all comes out very nicely.
Is this a fixed number of spatial dimensions? Started with just a set, and I wasn't sure.
Right now we have, so this is a very interesting question that I'm still working on. This is with one. If you do this quantification, you find out it doesn't always work. You can find events that this doesn't work, where this nice decomposition doesn't work. And in that case, what you can do is you can do it turns out to be a Pythagorean decomposition. It's derived in the paper how to do such a thing. But you can introduce another dimension effectively. So you take that anti-symmetric part, and it can decompose into other anti-symmetric parts. And these are all related according to Euclidean. They're added in the Euclidean way. So you can actually derive that. I can't seem to drive that there's three, but yeah.
So I guess you didn't have a space anywhere until now.
Yes, interesting.
So you just define it as like the difference between that depth and depth of view. I guess that's good.
We have a concept of ordering, which that's clearly related to time. Time is one dimensional; it reflects that. It's no concept of space.
So in principle, this could be. There could be no dimension here. It could be a fractal or something. So,
it's in this picture. It's a construct. It's not a thing.
What do you mean by a scalar?
A scalar. Well, one real number. So you represent this.
Real number, so I don't.
Right. So instead of a pair. So to distinguish from a pair representation. So this is a pair representation for the interval, right? Which because of this, you could represent as complex numbers if you wanted and things like this, which is interesting. But what's really important is that you need a pair of numbers.
You can third observer whether they see the same scalar.
Ah, that's interesting. Yes, if the observer is synchronized with the first two, there are two situations that can happen. One is, yes, they either agree or they disagree. And if they disagree, it turns out that the decomposition is entirely time-like. And what this equates to is if Philip and I are the two observers, and if you, I'll use spatial language here, but really you can drive this with the partially ordered sets. If the event is between us, or the two events are both between us, if we bound them, then we would agree. And if Ariel was over there looking, he would also agree if we were all collinear or we were all synchronized. So you can actually define, you can define the concept of collinearity based on the synchronization. So Ariel would agree. However, now if Philip and Ariel are used to quantify these events, they would actually find that they're time-like separated. And the reason is because if there's two events that that flash, they couldn't tell the difference if it was one event here at one point in space that flashed at different times, or if there were two spatially separated events that flashed at the same time. They can't actually tell the difference because they're along the same line and they're just measuring times of arrival. So you need to triangulate, so you need another observer. So they would agree sometimes, but there are times that they would disagree, but they would disagree in a very special way.
The reason I ask is because in subvector relativity, the S squared is kind of the same for all the observer.
You
have a single.
That's a different question. So now if I were to, if you have the event that, and it's bounded so that it's happening between the two guys, so that two observers can actually are sufficient to quantify this, then if you have two that are quote moving here in this picture, there's no sense of motion. But if these other two are linearly related to the other, synchronized to the other two chains, then yes, you can prove that this is invariant. So the derivation continues from here to derive that this is invariant for all observers, and then you can derive the Lorentz contractions and transformations.
So there's a notion that all the observers have a velocity in the same direction. If in the three-dimensional space, observers may have velocity in different dimensions.
Oh, right. When you do this decomposition into multiple dimensions, you'll get different directions, and they'll agree. And yeah.
implicitly, actually, shouldn't you be working on something like an uncountable generalization of lattices rather than countable? Does that change anything? Because everything in here, this is all actually the picture that you drew, even was finite, never mind, just countable.
Right.
And we're now going to somehow put this in real value numbers. And I'm just wondering if anything changes in the mathematics when you go from countable lattices.
This was just submitted last night, I don't know. This work on special relativity was performed with my student Nisha Bahraini, and of course Philip and I interacted a lot on this as well, and I'd like to thank all of these individuals and my brother for doing the artwork. So thank you.
Very good.
Yes.
Can I ask how this relates to, there's work by Rob, who was writing in the team, I believe, that you might, A.A. Rob, where you take a causal relation that's fundamental. I think he has both causally precedes and chronologically precedes as the two causal relations, and then derives Minkowski geometry from that. I mean, he's not working in a post set, it's just a...
Right,
sorry,
I wasn't aware of that.
So there are all these discussions, I guess, more in the philosophy literature about sort of defining space-time, taking causal relations as fundamental. And it seems similar in spirit because you're starting with this relation of informed with respect to. So that's maybe something to look into. One question based on that is that I think they have to have two causal relations, both chronologically and causally precedes, to get the difference between time-like and null-separated events.
Hmm.
And it didn't seem like you had that.
No, you don't need that here.
Okay.
Yeah.
You control
it. Yeah. You have this notion of a dimension of a space by, say, how many different kind of observer you can put in. What I try to say is the example you gave apparently is for two observers moving in the same direction. And but in a three-dimensional space, you may put in, say, five or six different observers moving all different directions, whether from their relation or whether you can synchronize or not synchronize their clock, whether one can deduce the dimension of space.
Well, they can't all be synchronized with each other. They can be synchronized pairwise, or if they're any of their bodies collinear. But yeah, I don't know much more about dimensionality.
In a sense, whether in a three spatial dimension, there's only certain set of observer can be put in, not more. Say, like in one dimensional space,
right.
There's probably all the observer is have a certain spatial relation, but the place relation may be valid when you have a or three-dimensional space.
Right.
But this is...
Yep, that I don't know. Sadie?
Yeah, I stumbled over something that you said, that the points on the observer lines, they have to be dense in some sense. Later, when you make your decomposition into the symmetric and anti-symmetric part, you kind of, you know, the point has to be there, right? And I don't know what it means for a set to be dense.
Well, What it basically assuming is that you've got a continuous lattice. As long as everything is continuous, you can stretch it any way you want, and you can get this nice picture. Now this doesn't give you gravity, right? So clearly there's something, one of these assumptions isn't right. So either you've got a causality issue, or you've got this density of events is not right. So.
Simply that there's some homogeneity as you go up.
Yeah, well, yeah. If you've got, if they're dense, then it's uniform. Yeah. But the real point is that you can get this, you can derive this all from the lattice structure, and it's coming from associativity. So as regarding yesterday's talk on whether laws can change in time, you have a real big problem changing them in time because it comes down to what are you going to change? You're going to change associativity? That's what are you going to change it to? I don't know.
I was going to have some critical words about causal sets ideas tomorrow, but in the light of what was said yesterday, I'm not going to drop that. But let me make the comment now. I've long, I have to say, been rather sceptical about causal set ideas, mainly because I find the notion of causality, which goes in, very questionable. For me, causality is actually dynamical evolution of, in relativity, it's actually fields, which are continuous things. And as Einstein, in his famous debate with Ritz in 1909, said, Einstein argued retardation is not fundamental, it's just the arrow of time, it's a very special initial condition that at any point you go, essentially you only have outgoing waves rather than ingoing waves. But that's purely just a contingent fact, it's nothing whatever to do with that. So I find all of this idea that the causal structure, and once, as Voigt found the Lorentz transformation in 1886 or whatever it was, just from the fact that a wave equation automatically gives you Lorentz invariance. And for me, special relativity is just that all the fields of nature have the same light curve. So I have to say I'm rather sceptical about taking causality as a fundamental concept. That's not to say this isn't very nice and so forth, and I'm sure I don't want to dismiss right. it that, but I just have to put on record reservations about it.
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure where this can go.
Duly noted.
I'm not sure where this can go, but I intended here to put it in as an example of how you can derive laws from order, basically.
I was wondering if you thought of applying exactly the spatial cognition where you think of the simple chains not as an independent observer but as sensory pathways, and think of the coordination as sensory pathways stabilizing out a conception of a three-dimensional space. Identifying points among different sensory pathways as different kind of cognitions of the same event.
I have no idea about that. This is all very new. So, yeah, we've only been doing this for 2 months, actually. When it comes to dimensionality, it's still not clear. I can show the measures fall apart. You can't have more. The measures don't work if there's more than three spatial dimensions. But that doesn't mean that there don't exist events in that picture that can't be quantified, which is an interesting question. So, Lucien.
So my understanding is that if you have random graphs, especially big random graphs, then they won't naturally embed into the dimensional manifolds. So you must have extra assumptions that are doing quite a lot to reduce the effective dimension of space-time.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think that has to do with this assumption of always being able to find an event, such that. Whatever.
But that would be true in a very high-dimensional manifold as well, perhaps. So, presumably you want to be able to restrict the dimension down to something
right.
that's considerably less than the number of vertices in your graph. So.
Right. Yeah, that's been an interesting question. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. So you can remove half an event, say, when you have two synchronized observers, you can remove, say, half events. From one observer and remove half an hour to second observer also disorganized. If you uniformly say one every other one, you remove one. But the question is that can you remove events in an uneven way? Say here I remove less events and there I remove more events on this observer and I get a synchronized observer by removing events in a similar fashion if that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
This really try to mention whether the time the clock rates can be non-uniform. Whether the uniform clock rates is a relative concept or not.
Right. Well, here with these events, there's no notion of distance between.
But
you will quantify.
Right. Then you, a particular way to quantify, get you a uniform rate of a clock.
Right.
But then you can remove those events, make a density. And even relative to the first way, while we have a second way sometimes of quantifying it, also consistent but compared to the first quantization is uneven, whether this is possible.
I don't know. A lot of interesting things you could investigate.